Hello, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Monday, March 2nd, 2009, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge, with your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. That would be me.
Well, he's not done me yet, Bernard!
I'll get right to you, ma'am, right after this show, I promise. We're back today with that exceptional erotic author and novelist, the one and only James Lear. This is part two of my chat with James in this podcast series called The Erotic Mind. As you know, we've been chatting with erotic artists of every stripe in the hopes of uncovering something of the creative process involved in this specialized art form. If you somehow missed part one of this delightful yet provocative discussion, look for last week's podcast, number 102, on Dr. Dick's podcast page at the top of my site. Or just use the search function in the sidebar. Type in podcast number 102, and don't forget the number sign. Today, as a special treat, James will share with us a juicy passage from his best-selling novel, The Palace of Varieties. I'm currently deep into reading this brilliantly smutty work myself, and I have James and his generous publisher, Cleus Press, to thank for that, don't you know?
On we go. No rest for the wicked.
That is so true. Today's podcast sponsor is Ropex. Hey guys, let's talk a little bit about jizz production. For all of you out there who are worried that you are not making enough baby batter as you would like, or maybe you're shooting a nice load but it looks all watery and anemic, well, I have just the thing for you. The good folks at New Generation Labs bring us Ropex, the original Swedish ropes formula. Ropex is the natural way to increase semen volume, so that when you bust your nut, you'll have some nice ropey spunk spewing out your willy. Check out the Ropex review on the product reviews page at the top of drdicksexadvice.com. Scroll down till you find Review 21. You'll see that I've used Ropex myself, and like all of my reviews, I give you my unvarnished opinion. If you're looking for a little help in the spooge production department, visit the Ropex website today. Okay, on with the show. Welcome back, James, and thank you again for joining us. I'm doing a lot of thinking about the stuff that we talked about last week, and I'd like to pick up where we left off. We were talking about pornography and the difference between pornography and erotica, and I want to ask you about defining erotic art and how that plays out in your mind. To my mind, defining erotic art is difficult, since perceptions of both what is erotic and what is art fluctuate with time and by culture. For example, the depiction of a phallus in some cultures is not erotic, but merely a common symbol of potency or fertility. The same is true about words. Would you not agree?
Yes, I would. But when you consider the stuff that we can get away with now, with the stuff compared to the stuff that you could get away with 50 years ago, and the same applies to visual representation.
Yes.
I have a bit of a problem around all this terminology, because I think basically it all comes down to the same thing, which is sexual material.
Uh-huh.
I'm frequently asked what the difference is between erotica and pornography, or erotic and pornographic, because I use the terms fairly interchangeably.
Yes, you do.
I actually don't recognize any difference between them. Mm-hmm. And I think if you try to say that erotic is to do with suggestion or a certain sort of lyrical approach, or more to do with feelings and so on and so forth, and that pornography is just the half description of sex, you're on a ridiculous kind of sliding scale, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. I do respect the fact that certain people draw distinctions. I don't. I don't see that that's useful. It's just categorizing stuff yet further. I think sexual material of all sorts has a hard enough time without us tying our knickers in knots about what is and what is not pornographic.
Well, you know, we talked about this briefly last week, and when those distinctions are made, someone's going to come out on the short end of the stick, and somebody's going to be denigrated for, you know, oh, that's not real erotica, that's, you know, something else.
Well, I get people who denigrate my erotic writing as being something that is not really proper writing. You know, I've had people, you know what people are like. I mean, I've had people say to me, oh, that's just one of your dirty books. You know, and I say to them, well, what do you mean the best-selling award-winning dirty books? You know, because if you think that writing a book that not only has great characters, a lot of humour, a rattling good plot, some zippy dialogue, and is so sexy that it makes you want to masturbate twice per chapter is easy, then you have a go. You know, these books are a success because they're good. There's the only distinction that I draw really is one that I try to quote Oscar Wilde, although I always get it wrong, but he said something along the lines of there is no such thing as an immoral book. Books are either well written or badly written. Mm-hmm. And I would say the same thing about pornographic sexual literature. There is a hell of a lot of it that is awful.
Yes.
And it isn't sexy. It is only consumed because there are some people who are so hungry for the depiction of certain forms of sexual activity that they will read or watch any crap.
Yes.
To do it well and to bring some proper literary quality to that stuff is not easy. It can't be done. You can't write erotica just because you have a vivid sexual imagination. You know, being able to masturbate does not mean that you can write an erotic novel. Sadly, a lot of people seem to think that's the case.
Yes.
You know, writing is a craft like any other craft, and it's not something that, you know, you just pick up a pen and start doing it. If I had a dollar for every time somebody said to me, I've thought about writing an erotic novel, I would be a very rich man.
It's the same thing in making porn, interestingly enough. I am approached constantly by very attractive men who tout themselves as being very attractive and, you know, sex-possessed with a big dick, and they think that they're going to be masters as porn actors. And you know,
how awful for you, Dick. It must be...
It's terrible.
It must be such a burden.
Because, you know, one has to let these folks down somewhat gently. And these are people who I know for sure I'm going to have problems with, because they are so cocksure, so to speak, as it were, that they are capable of doing this. And what I tell them is, when you're making porn, when you're shooting porn, when you're acting in porn, it is not like having sex, you know, with a chosen partner in the confines of or the privacy of your own home. It's not that at all. It's stop and start, and it's hurry up and wait, and then it's sex on demand. And few people can do that.
And the other thing that's important about all of this is that what matters in any of this is not the writer or the performer or the director or anybody. It's the consumer. Uh-huh. And if you're not turning the consumer on, if you're in it for some head trip of your own, you're a failure.
Yes.
If you're a pornographic performer and your only interest is in your own sexual pleasure, you're a dud. You know, we've all seen them as well. You know, these people who, you know, whether it's on screen or on stage or whatever it is, their only interest in this is how good it makes them feel.
Yes.
By the same token, there are writers who clearly are writing stuff because it's working out some kind of erotic fixation that they have.
Uh-huh.
They're not thinking about their audience. And the only point in writing anything, any form of literature, whether it's poetry, whether it's the most high-flown literary fiction, whether it's comedy, whether it's mystery, whether it's erotica, is what you deliver to the audience. And any art form that doesn't put the audience first is a dud. And is you know, this is why I have so much issue with conceptual art and things like this, because, you know, they're not audience focused. It's all to do with look at me, I'm the artist, and that's just bullshit.
Yes. Yes. Has reading and writing erotica empowered you as a gay man?
It's empowered me as a writer. I don't think I need it very much in power as a game, and to be honest with you, I mean, by the time I started doing this, I was already well into my 40s, and you know, if you're not empowered by the time you pass about 35, you're never going to be. So, you know, life empowered me as a gay man, and life and love and my own experiences empowered me as a gay man. But it's really definitely empowered me as a writer, and the reason why is because I think it's made me much more aware of delivering a good package to the consumer, and it's liberated me from any strangling concepts of high art that I may have had before. I think that a lot of people who start writing, particularly when you're younger, your models as a writer are often, you know, the high literary achievers, and you try to emulate that. And I think you can't really do that until you've got a lot of good workable fiction under your belt. So, to be honest with you, writing erotic fiction, which is after all genre fiction of a sort, meant that I had to focus on delivering the goods. That, you know, you're giving people something in an area that they have certain expectations, and your job is to fulfil those expectations. It's not to subvert them. It's not to lead the audience on and then let them down and turn it on its head and be tricksy. It's to give them what they want. And I think that, you know, that sounds a bit crass in some ways, but I think that if more writers actually concentrated on giving audiences, readers, what they want, and less on, you know, being really clever and original and trying to break the mold every time, I think we'd have a lot less rubbish fiction being published.
So something that a writer, in order to be successful, needs to have X amount of cum shots or X amount of sex scenes
in erotic
pages?
Yeah, in erotic fiction, there are certain rules. I hesitate to go into them in too much detail because it's giving away the tricks of my trade. But I would say that I try always to deliver... I try to deliver two good wanks per chapter. Will American readers understand what I mean by wank?
Yes, absolutely.
Jolly good.
They screw them, they don't.
Yeah, exactly. or one for the over 40s, as I always say. So I try to deliver two good climaxes per chapter. And I do very, very consciously think about people masturbating when they read this work. That is what this is for.
Right.
That's the purpose of it. It's not to make you think, wow, isn't sex a deep and dark and fascinating thing? No. It's to turn you on and make you come.
Right.
Along the way, it gives you a lot of other stuff, but the primary purpose is to turn you on and make you come. In exactly the same way that a whodunit, a crime novel, is to make you guess. It's to make you go on that journey of guessing whodunit. A horror novel, the prime purpose of a horror novel is to scare you. A romance novel is to make you engage in that whole journey of will they, won't they, and all of that. So, you know, erotic fiction has a purpose, and it is to make you masturbate. So I that's absolutely key to everything I do. And I think if you're writing in the area of erotica and you're shy about the fact that people are going to be masturbating when they read your books, then you better really think about another area to write in. I really wanted Amazon to give away a free packet of tissues with every book.
I mean, it's a great idea.
Yeah.
You know, and a little package of lube. You know,
absolutely, and it could have my website address on
exactly,
each tissue.
Exactly. Mm. Which gets me to a question. Most of the erotic fiction that I read or I have seen around are short stories. They're very short, and so writing an erotic novel is different, unless of course one is the novel is just a collection of, you know, short vignettes, these sexual vignettes. What's your take on that?
Well, this is a very interesting question. The short story, in some ways, is the perfect form for erotic fiction.
Yes.
Because it's one wank.
Yes.
And that's really what I grew up on, was magazine fiction, which, you know, they were, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000 words long, and that's enough to set up the situation.
We used to call that one-handed literature.
Exactly so. It would set the situation up, get the characters to the point of will they, won't they, then they do it, there's a good description of the sex, then it's over and you come and that's it, you wipe up, put your magazine away. Now, that in a way is the perfect form for erotic fiction. I actually can't write short stories. I've tried and tried. I mean, I've done a few, but I'm not good at them. So I prefer the novel. It's just what I've always done. And the thing about an erotic novel is it has to repeat that cycle of encounter, will they, won't they, sexual activity, and then afterwards. It has to repeat that cycle many, many times. So, in fact, you're in danger of it being, and then they had sex, and then they had sex again, and then they had sex again, which is really, really tedious.
Yeah.
So what I have to give them to hold it all together is an overarching plot.
Yes.
And I think that, and every sexual encounter is another step on the road of that plot.
Uh-huh.
There's never just sex for sex's sake, or very, very rarely. Sometimes there is. I just can't resist it. But you know, usually the sex has a purpose. I mean, in the Back Passage, for instance, which was my biggest seller, and it was the first of the kind of detective ones that I did, every sexual encounter was the detective using sex as a way of getting another piece of information out of a character. So he would seduce somebody, or he would give sexual favors to somebody, or whatever, in order to get another piece of the puzzle. Exactly. So I have to give these novels an overarching story structure, literary structure, and that is absolutely essential if you're going to write erotica that is longer than a couple of thousand words. You better have a damn good, strong plot structure that overarches everything, and that the sex is a servant of that plot, just as the hero is it serves your ideas, and you know, the dialogue serves the plot. Everything has to work towards that end. So I want people to keep turning pages,
yeah,
not just because they're sexually aroused and they want to get off, but also because I want them to, at the end of a chapter, I want them to think, oh God, what's going to happen in the next chapter? Oh, how is this going to be resolved? So they're page turners as well as being one-handed reading, you know. So you need, I mean, people must get to a terrible mess, Dick, when they're, you know, they're holding the book in one hand. I think I don't need to go on, but I imagine there have been some very messy accidents with my books, and I'm very glad
they come in that, you know, plastic covered pages.
Well, they do have kind of quite glossy covers, and I think there's a good reason.
Excellent. So, I was going to ask, do you suppose that reading erotica is a benefit for people? Does it increase their sexuality? Does it provide a person an expanded vocabulary for communicating sexual desires to others?
Probably, yes. I think it probably does. I mean, one woman wrote to me and told me that she reads my books in bed, and she gets really turned on, then she leaps on her husband.
Uh-huh.
And I hope he's grateful. That's all I can say. I don't know. I mean, I think that pornographic material, sexual material, exists in a peculiar relation to the people that actually read it, because for some people, if they're using this as an aid to masturbation, then that suggests that de facto that they're actually not having sex with other people very much. So I, you know, certainly the times when I've consumed porn myself to any great degree have been when I haven't been having regular sex with real live human beings. So what I always try to do is I try to portray sex in a very positive, celebratory, upbeat way. I want people to close these books when they finish reading them and think, wow, sex is fantastic. I love sex. I love my own sexuality. I feel great about it. Now, a lot of the stuff that I read when I was younger did not do that. There was a lot of writing that basically made you feel quite bad about sex, and it was always stressing the kind of hidden taboo aspect of it. I mean, I write scenes that are quite disgusting. They're quite, sometimes there are elements of coercion or humiliation, because, you know, I know that people get off on that as a sort of fantasy. But so while some scenes are quite, they can be quite, I wouldn't say unpleasant, because I would never write about violence, for instance, right. Or, you know, that's to me is an instant passion killer. I can't stand it. But so, you know, I mean, even if there's a little bit of coercion, there would never be anything really truly unpleasant. But I want people at the end of the day to, it's not really about enhancing their sexual vocabulary in terms of what they may do physically with another person or with themselves, but it's about saying sex is wonderful, fun, let's enjoy it, let's laugh about it, let's communicate about it, let's enjoy masturbating, let's enjoy our own bodies and other people's bodies without guilt and shame.
That's one of the reasons that, you know, I encourage my therapy clients, as a sex therapist, I encourage my therapy clients to read erotica together aloud. It gives voice to, you know, oftentimes to prohibitive words that, you know, are not part of their common vocabulary, things that they would trip over if they had to say them aloud to somebody, but they could actually read them, and then that, you know, loosens them up some. It, of course, you know, heightens the mood. It encourages communication, because I'm actually saying words and expressing thoughts, maybe not my own, at least initially, but it does work. It helps people to open themselves up sexually, and I think it's one of the great tools that I have in working with, you know, sexually repressed people.
Well, I hope it helps. I mean, my prime, I've never really thought about it as a therapeutic tool, but I wouldn't dare to make any comment about that, but I hope that what this gives people is a very entertaining experience, and I hope that I really want people to laugh and to think, oh, how could he write something as outrageous as that? And it's quite tongue in cheek. However serious it may get, even the more serious books are quite tongue in cheek. And I want them to it to be all part of a very, very entertaining process that just so happens to make them feel sexually aroused as part of that. You know, I think that there are lots of books in which you're made to laugh or you're scared or whatever, and I just think that being turned on should be one of those things that can happen when you're reading a book. I mean, there's actually a lot of fairly highbrow literary fiction,
exactly,
which contains erotic elements.
Yes.
And I think often, you know, there's far dirtier stuff in some of those books than there is in my erotic novels even, but, you know, that they tend to be all about saying something dreadfully serious about human relations when they're writing about sex. I want to write about sex in a way that is about sex. It's about turning you on and having some fun. You know, I do the other stuff in my other books. I'm not dismissing that.
Yes, I understand.
You know, sex is very much about relations, but in these books, the erotic books, sex is about sex. And, you know, I will call a dick a dick. I'm not about euphemisms or literary metaphors or whatever, because that, you know, some of the literified sex scenes that I've read from other people just make me, like, you know. So, you know, I just think this is about it's celebration, it's simple, it's like eating. Mm-hmm.
Could you share another piece of your work?
I'm going to give you a bit
give
from
it
the
to
palace.
Me, give it to me. The
give it to me, baby. I want to give you something from Palace of Varieties, which is quite a different one. This is, in some ways the darkest book that I've written of this type, and it's a sort of rake's progress through the sexual underworld of London in the 1930s, and it's about a boy who becomes a stagehand at a theatre, at a music hall, and he becomes a prostitute, and he's not always a very nice person. It's in some ways I think it might be the best one of them. I'm not sure. It's probably the most literary. It's also the dirtiest. Mm-hmm. Now I wanted to just read you a bit where he has become a model, an artist's model. and he's modelling for this elderly artist whose name is Heringham, and he's doing a sort of life class for Heringham and some of his students who are basically a group of dirty old men. And Paul, the hero, is performing with the with Heringham's rather virile servant Grimes. So they're in the studio, and they're sort of posing and performing for this group of voyeurs. Grimes led me back to the dais, sat on the block, put me over his knee, and commenced a firm spanking. This seemed to delight them all. In my experience of servicing the upper classes, I've always found that the punishments of the schoolroom and nursery have a particular significance. I played my part, screwing up my face and yelping as that great shovel of a hand bore down on my bum. In truth, Grimes was not too harsh on me, and administered just enough pain to get my cheeks glowing. My cock, stimulated by this general blood flow to the nether regions, pressed against his sinuous thigh and smeared it with pre-cum. Once my bum was warmed up, it was time for the main event, in which we would be fucked in every conceivable position. We started off doggy style. I knelt on all fours while Grimes steered himself into me from the rear. Mercifully, I had taken cocks almost as big before. Remember, I had been broken for riding by Mr. Newsom, who shared Grimes's girth, if he lacked perhaps an inch of length. I knew how to control my breathing, to ride through the pain, to relax sufficiently to convert it into pleasure. And by the time Grimes had been inside me for a few moments, I was ready to take anything he could give me. Grimes was a true professional, holding himself upright with his arms out of the way so that the gents had an unobstructed view of his prick moving in and out of my arsehole, pulling the lips back with each withdrawal, then plunging into the hilt again. I, for my part, tried to show that I was still as hard as before, but gradually I was losing my focus on the act of performance and simply enjoying the ride. I was gratified to see that all the voyeurs were now wanking openly, and that Lord Simon had persuaded Banker to lend him a couple of fingers in order that he might experience the same sensations in a lesser form as I was. Will that be...
I see there's a wonderful sense of humour in it as well.
Well, you know, I always say about humour that humour in erotica is like yeast in making bread.
I agree.
Nothing is going to rise without it.
Is it possible for you, as an erotic author, to eroticize something that you personally don't find sexy?
No, it's not possible. Everything I write about, I do find sexy. I write about the type of men that I find attractive. I write about situations that I find attractive, that I find a turn on. They're not necessarily things that I've necessarily done. that sounds like a disclaimer. but no, I couldn't, in all honesty, write about something that didn't turn me on some level. I mean, that, you know, I try to keep it real, and I think people respond to that. I think that there's a danger in this kind of writing, that you become formulaic, and I try to keep it fresh. I mean, that nearly all the men that I write about or describe are based on real people whom I find attractive.
Right.
So I've got a specific person in mind for every single character, and it's my way of having those people, I suppose.
Right.
So I am engaging sexually with the material myself. That said, I do not sit here tapping away at my typewriter with a hard-on, because that, you know, what I'm... maybe I do get turned on when I'm thinking about how the story's going to go, or how a scene's going to be played out, but more often I sort of am rubbing my hands together thinking, ooh, that'll be fun, and I'm not kind of getting turned on about it. So what I'm concentrating on when I'm actually writing it is making the scene work and making it good fun and lively and witty and all of those things. But no, everything I write about, you know, from the sort of tenderest scenes of lovemaking through to, you know, scenes of people pissing on each other in bathrooms, are all things that I personally find sexually exciting.
Great. What do you look for in the works of other erotic artists, written or graphic?
I don't read very much anymore in this area because I find that it kind of clogs up my creative tubes. What I look for in visual porn is I look for some sense of, how can I put this? I think that it's very boring to watch two very, very attractive people just having sex.
Yes.
You know, there are certain videos which I find deathly dull, which yes. start off with two incredibly buff athletic guys in white Calvin Kleins just going, you know, they're identical and they just have sex. Well, you know, that's quite nice, but I prefer that the important point for me is that point when you think, is it going to happen or isn't it? It's that moment, that tipping point. So I'm looking for that. I'm looking for some kind of build-up. And I'm also looking for a bit of contrast between the guys. I always try to do this in my own writing, that there's some kind of contrast between the two sexual protagonists. And I look for that in the visual porn as well. So, you know, and for me personally, I'm, much as I like looking at a beautiful, graceful, athletic young man, I also want that to be contrasted with, you know, different ages and shapes.
Yes.
I mean, I'm much more interested myself in different, you know, in different types of men,
yes.
from that kind of one cliche. So that's what I'm looking for. I like a bit of role playing and a bit of a sense of the taboo and a bit of a sense, yes. of a sense of naughtiness rather than just, you know, two gorgeous men in a condo in Palm Beach,
yeah.
with some nasty Hessian wallpaper and some dried twigs in a vase, kind of, you know. you can tell that my mind's wandering because I'm looking at the interior decor and it's ridiculous. But, you know, I'm not really that interested in just you know, two really amazingly attractive human beings. I'm sure the same thing applies in heterosexual porn.
I feel the same way. I mean, when I was shooting a lot of porn, the thing that I was most interested in was the seduction, the allure, rather than the bumping of parts. I mean, parts,
yeah,
bumping, you can do that, and then it's, well, okay, that's pretty interesting. But
I think you need all of those things. I think you need the situation, you need the encounter, you need the tipping point of will they, won't they, the realization that they get going to, and that in gay stuff is particularly powerful because of the sort of taboos and,
yes.
the unknown surrounding whether or not both parties are up for it. And then you need the act itself. And I think you need all of those things. I think it would be disingenuous to say that we don't actually need a good graphic portrayal of a sexual act.
Exactly, yes.
But I'm not going to be excited by that unless I know how they've got there. You know, I actually like to see them getting hard, for
yes.
instance. I don't like to see a hard cock just making its appearance. I like to see it getting there. You know, to me, it's that promise, that expectation that is exciting.
Yeah. Or people meeting, and then, you know, the next frame, they're in bed, undressed. And I'm going,
yeah.
Well, wait a minute.
Of course,
how did you get there?
Being a fan
is really a hot thing for me.
Yeah. And of course, being a fan of 70s and 80s porn, I really like all the crass dialogue as well. You know, have you been to this bar before? Yes, I have. You know, I love all of that crass stuff, but, you know.
Who are your inspirations and your sexual heroes?
Wow.
You mentioned Agatha last week.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she's not really a sexual hero.
But your inspiration, yes?
Yeah, I mean, my inspirations in terms of literature are, there are so many of them that each of my books is based on a specific book or books. The first one I wrote, The Low Road, is a rewriting of Robert Louis Stevenson's Kidnapped,
wow.
which is one of the great masterpieces of world literature, in my opinion, and is also, I think, one of the most homoerotic books ever
yes.
written. If you haven't read it recently, listeners, go and have another look at it, because it's a very, very interesting book. And in fact, one of the things that inspired me to start this whole James Lear thing was that I had recently reread Kidnapped at the time, and I was thinking, my God, this is a sexy book. So that was the inspiration for that. Other books obviously Agatha Christie, as anybody who's read my stuff will realise, I absolutely revere Agatha Christie. I think that she is one of the she's overlooked as a literary figure in some ways, but I think she's one of the most important writers of the 20th century. And for the Palace of Varieties, which is, as I was saying earlier, the most sort of literary one, that is inspired to some extent by Balzac, who is another extremely homoerotic writer, specifically Le Père Goriot and Illusion Perdue, Lost Illusions. It's also inspired by Trilby by Gérard du Maurier. Now, these are not sexual heroes, they're literary heroes, and you probably guess by what I'm saying that to me the starting point for nearly all of these is a literary model, and yes. You know, I do that quite sincerely. I take these, you know, that I wrote one of these called Hot Valley, which was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek reference to Cold Mountain, the Civil War novel, and it's an American Civil War novel. It's a bit of a sprawling epic in some ways. It's the least structured of all of them, because it was a sort of homage to Cold Mountain and also to other Civil War books like The Red Badge of Courage and to a lesser extent Gone with the Wind, and also to that fabulous movie, the name of which completely escapes me, that will come to me later, with Nicole Kidman in. Oh, that was Cold Mountain. What's the other one with Tobey Maguire in it? Ride with the Devil. Tobey Maguire, who, by the way, if he's listening, just write in and I'll give you my address. Toby, shoot your web in my direction. So there's always a strong
disputantum est.
But I don't think there's not very much disputanding the appeal of Tobey Maguire. But in terms of sexual heroes, my real sexual heroes, you know, are not so much writers as people who've worked in the visual media. I am a great admirer of the pioneering physique photographers. I've done a great deal of work and research in this area, and I have a book coming out later this year under the name Rupert Smith, which is set largely in that 50s and 60s era, and set in that world of physique photography. And, you know, I think that those photographers and models from that period who had the courage to create erotic representations of the male body were real heroes, and they brought us together at a time when a very dark time for gay people, and the imagery that they produced under such duress and such threat of legal retribution, they're so powerful and so beautiful, some of those images. So there are those photographers like Bob Meiser, Bruce of LA. In England, we had John Barrington Scott, lots of people like that. They are my erotic heroes, really, the photographers and the models who created those images.
And they're so enduring. I mean, they're so timeless.
They're very timeless. I mean, you know, you can see a lot of this stuff online now, so because, you know, there's one of the wonders of the internet that you can actually find this work. And to me, that men have never looked as attractive as they looked in the 1950s. I love that style, you know, the slicked up hair, the jeans that were just coming in, you know, the whole kind of Marlon Brando look that was so popular. And, you know, you can look at some of these photographs, and men have never, ever looked as sexually attractive as they did at that time. I mean, that's absolutely my favourite look. And they were photographed in such an amazing way. You know, they took great care over them, but these images were also, when you know the history of this pre-Stonewall era, they were very, very transgressive, these images,
yes.
And a lot of people landed up in prison because of them. But they weren't hardcore images even. I mean, you know,
to take
a picture of a nude man at that time was a big deal. You know, now, you know, I could be sitting here with a webcam on my laptop, you know, and we could be having a jolly time and nobody would be any the wiser. But in those days, you know, to actually possess these things or the negatives or to have modeled for them could put you in prison.
That's right. Which makes them all the more precious to my mind.
And we should never forget it. Yeah. We take so much for granted now. Young people don't know this stuff. I don't blame them because, you know, it's not taught.
Yeah.
And there aren't that many books on it. And I think that older people have a real responsibility to keep the history alive and not just to go, oh, that was the bad old days.
Yes. Listen, our time is coming to an end. I am so grateful for you taking so much of your time with us. Can you, before we go, can you walk us or give us your website address and walk us around a bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, the main website for James Lear is a MySpace. So if you go to www.myspace.com/JamesLearFiction, all one word, James Lear Fiction, that will take you to the MySpace and you can become my imaginary friend and you can do all sorts of things. But that will keep you up to date with what's coming out and what's already available. To be honest, you know, that's been one of the most useful things for me in charting how this work is received, because without the kind of audience feedback that I get from that, I wouldn't know how the work is received. And while I have to say that I don't write because of how people respond to the books, I write what I write because that's what I write. I've never changed what I write because of what any reader has said to me. At least it tells me that I'm doing the right thing, you know. And I like to know who's reading it and what the kind of response they're giving it to me. So you know, it's quite interactive, and I love all that stuff, because being a, you know, full-time writer, I'm desperately lonely, so I like people to get in touch.
You poor pathetic creature.
I know. The other place where you can go for a more sort of global overview of my entire career is www.rupertsmith.org.uk, which will tell you about everything I do, the other books that I've written. So
have links on my posting to your sites.
Fabulous. I would also just like to tell people that there's various stuff, you know, coming out later this year. The Low Road is being republished in my Rupert Smith novel Man's World, which is the one set largely in the Physique era, is coming out later this year also.
Cool. And where can we buy your work? Does your site link to where we can buy your work?
You can buy my work anywhere. I mean, it's all on... it's all on Amazon.
Okay, cool. You know, excellent.
I would like to push people towards buying it direct from Cleus, my own
okay.
Because... you know, I think that the small independent presses need to be supported.
Absolutely.
And Cleus have been so amazingly supportive of this work. You know, they published it at a time when nobody else would even look at it. And, you know, good for them, because they've had a big success with it, which is great. So you can go direct to the Cleus Press website.
Good.
But otherwise, no, it's very widely available. It sells oodles on Amazon, so you can get it from there.
Well, James, Rupert, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And I will be in touch.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me.
Good, good, good. We'll see you in cyberspace. What a fantastic show, huh? Tune in next week for more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Ropex. I know a lot of you guys got it in your head that the amount of cum you produce and the velocity of your money shot are somehow associated with virility. Well, I don't buy that logic necessarily, but who among us doesn't like a nice puddle of dickwad to play with and admire? Ropex can help you build the volume of your ejaculate and thus increase your orgasmic contractions. I'm happy to recommend Ropex to anyone who worries about puny spunk production. Again, I invite you to check out my review of Ropex on the product reviews page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for review 21.
Gilbert can't get the juice. I've got a husband who can't get the juice.
Maybe we can cover that in another podcast on another day. Listen, sex fans, there's one more piece of news that I want to tell you about. I have another series of podcast interviews going called Sex Edgeucation. We are investigating the fetish and kink world and discussing topics like BDSM, power play, swinging, with prominent practitioners and advocates of unconventional sexual expressions and lifestyles. This new series, which premiered Wednesday, February 11th, will continue on Wednesdays. My regular podcasts like this one
remains on Mondays. Be sure to look for all of my podcasts on iTunes. Once in the podcast section, all you have to do is search for Dr. Dick's Sex Advice. Don't forget to subscribe. And when you do, feel free to leave a comment. Until next time, remember, sex is good, and good sex? That's even better. Over and out.